Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. You can download our 2024 sponsor kit on our homepage at onstrategyshowcase.com. We are going to be recording the show live from Dublin, Ireland on May 29th at the Guinness Storehouse Gravity Bar. Tickets will go on sale around May 1. I'll let you guys know as we get a little bit closer. It's actually shaping up to be an amazing panel of guests, and I'll be able to share more in the next week or two on exactly what that is. Grania Wafer and the entire Guinness events team have been amazing for hosting us and helping make it all come together. In fact, the larger Irish marketing community is getting involved, so it's hopefully going to be a big success on the night. If not, I'll just slip out the back door since few of you actually know what I look like. That said, back to today, we have episode one in our new three-episode CFO-CMO series. For some, the CFO and CMO are roles that speak different languages, and some view them as having sort of conflicting objectives. However, there are teams that have created a common language and approach that makes working together far more successful. We want to explore the nature of these successful relationships in this series through conversations with CFO, CMO teams that seem to have it right, or at least better than most. Here's a clip from today's episode.
The day Timothy arrived, I burst into his office and handed him The Case for Creativity by James Herm, which effectively tries over 30 years to decode why better creative is good for business. And I said, you like numbers, right? And there are some numbers in this book, so have a read over the weekend. And, you know, it wasn't about Timothy accepting the tenet of The Case for Creativity, the book. It was about me demonstrating, look, I understand you're going to need some ammo here, some understanding, and I'm here to help you wrap your head around what we're doing, but this stuff works.
That's Johnny Cahill, CMO of Heineken USA. He's joined by Timothy Bodart, Heineken USA's chief financial officer. We talk about why their relationship works, how they got there, and advice they have for others. So I'm joined for the intro to this episode by Mike Menkes. He is Group Senior Vice President at Analytic Partners in New York. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Fergus.
I was really struck during this first episode when talking to Johnny and Tim about what seems so obvious but is not in every situation. There was this idea of data, third-party data, having agreed on what those sources are, how much tension that relieves in the relationship if we're not pitching each other on disparate data sources and everything is in one dashboard and it's agreed upon enterprise-wide. That is a huge way to avoid tensions that can exist in this relationship. How do brands get to that state?
The way to get to it is really to make sure that the CFO and the CMO are speaking a common language and are talking about, you know, true business impacts. And that's one of the ways that's really important for the CMO and the marketing organization to be to having an impact they want to have on the organization, which is driving growth. And it's to do so by making sure the metrics are tied to business outcomes. And they need to be reliable. Needs to be a reliable understanding of what drives the business. It needs to include not just marketing data. So there are elements of aligning on metrics that need to be controllable and non-controllable factors. They need to be commercial in nature. So not just online data or offline data. It's got to include, you know, direct and indirect effects. It's got to be incremental versus absolute. And you have to be clear about are the metrics short-term, are they long-term, or are they a combination of the two? So it's really important for the, you know, the CMO and the CFO to get together and align on what are the right metrics and right way of looking at the business so that we're speaking a common language.
What does Analytic Partners mean when they use the term commercial analytics? What is commercial?
Commercial is really taking a view at the overall business and making sure that we're looking at the whole business and not just a part of the business. When we're looking at portions of the business, it can be misleading. It can be incomplete, and it might not be telling the true story around what's driving the business. So that's why commercial analytics and a commercial view of the business is really crucial to make sure that we're making the right decisions for true business growth.
Thanks, Mike. And thanks to Analytic Partners for sponsoring this series. So here is episode one of our CFO CMO series with Johnny Cahill, CMO, and Tim Bodart, CFO of Heineken USA. Enjoy. So this is a series that I think a lot of people in the industry have wanted to see happen, because this is a pretty critical relationship for anybody who works in marketing, because we tend to not have eyes on this relationship or a lens on the relationship, because it's just too many steps away from us. So it is great to be able to have some super senior folks here from major global brands be a part of this series, and these are the guys who have agreed to be in our first episode from Heineken USA. Welcome, Tim. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Fergus. Absolutely a pleasure to be on this podcast, and a pleasure to be here with our CMO as well, Johnny Wool.
Yeah, Johnny, thank you so much for being here also.
Yeah, no worries. Any excuse to spend some time with the CFO, right?
That's right. I love it.
This is going to cost me.
It's probably going to cost you, yeah. So let's start off. We've got a bunch of questions from listeners, which we will hopefully sprinkle them in throughout the conversation, and so people will know that that's actually happening. But let's start off, Johnny. Can you tell us how you would describe the role that marketing plays in the Heineken business?
Yeah, I think it's a good place to start. So, I mean, if you reflect on our business, particularly in the US, we've a premium portfolio of brands in what is often a commoditized category. So for us, marketing and our commercial activities at the center of how we justify that price premium. I mean, if you go back to the marketing textbooks 101, you have to, let consumers, people understand why you're charging the price you charge. And for us, marketing and brand power, brand differentiation, the meaningfulness of our brands is a crucial component in allowing us to bring a premium portfolio to the market. So I'm very fortunate as a CMO in this boardroom to operate in an environment that believes in the power of the discipline, which I recognize for many of the listeners isn't always the case. In many cases, marketing is seen as a cost, and often a bad cost. And in our case, it's a building cost that unlocks disproportionate performance and margin. So it's a very positive environment for us in that regard, but it's at the core of what we do as a business. We are brewers and we are brand builders. And I guess that's how we see it. So that's a nice place to be.
So how about from your perspective, Tim, what's your perspective on the role of marketing? And have you experienced it to be different in other roles you may have had in the past?
Yeah, so no, I fully agree with what Johnny said in terms of what the role of marketing is here at Heineken USA. You would have, indeed, in my past, I've seen also the other side where you would command a very, very high, for example, market share, or where you're more of a commodity. I think the meaningfulness or the necessity to be able to differentiate through marketing is sometimes less. For example, I've spent 6 years in Africa, and some of the countries there, the key differentiator would be your route to market and how do you get yourself just in a point of sale, which is more elevated than, for example, doing more marketing effort in order to capture consumers. But here at Heineken USA, I think indeed with where we play and our relative position in the market and the competitiveness of the US being an absolute bull market, marketing and brand power are absolutely key to drive rate of sale.
So it's an interesting distinction, Fergus, that the US is particularly a pull market. So you've got to create, if you will, brand power that's magnetic, and then the systemology kicks in with our distributor partners and our customers to get it to the consumer. But it certainly starts maybe at a higher level in the funnel, which is a great place to be.
Does being a premium brand require that you have a premium budget, or what's the distinction that you're trying to make when you use the word premium?
I think it's more of a philosophical point rather than a financial one. Being a premium brand means you do fabulous things that are magnetic for consumers, that you have a philosophy where your brand is only as good as the worst thing that it does, where you clearly demonstrate to people you value their business and in turn unlock a willingness to pay. I don't think it's as linear as, I mean, look, do we disproportionately invest in marketing? Yes, we do, because we believe in it as an unlocker of business growth. But even the smallest things that you do as a premium brand matter. And that can be an interaction. It can be a tweet. It can be a TV ad. And one of those things can be free. And one of those things can be millions of dollars. But it's about the consistency with which you show up. But to answer the question under the question, yes, we do invest behind the brands. And we do believe that consumers can feel that thing in the way that they can feel a Mercedes is different to a Volkswagen or a GM or a Heineken is different to all of the beer brands that are out there. We believe in that. We do put our budgets where our strategy and our beliefs are. But for us, it's a philosophical point as much as a financial point.
So Tim, is the term brand used in the boardroom? Is that a common term that's used within Heineken?
A lot. Yeah, we measure brand power in three different metrics, and that is coming back, and especially all the discussions on budgets, but also the periodical reviews. We bring that back to the table, and certain of these things are lagging indicators. But where we need to project it towards the future and say if we want to change or if we want to be growing certain metrics of these brand power elements, how do you do that and what do we need in terms of investments? So that comes back a lot.
So is there a sort of a distinction that is seen between a brand and performance marketing? Because a lot of people are that term is pretty consistent. It's becoming even more consistent here in the U.S. Is there that distinction at Heineken, or is everything, Johnny, seen as going to brand?
Yeah, I mean, look, we have these debates, and Fergus, you're seeing these all the time, upper funnel, lower funnel, brand versus performance. Brand is performance, and performance is brand. We've got to be, because the people who are absorbing the messaging are building a holistic picture of what your brand stands for, whether it's a piece of Super Bowl advertising or an email to drive conversion, it's still cumulatively additive to your brand power or not, or detrimental to your brand power. And so for us, we see them holistically. That's not to say that we don't have brand-led activities and brand-led initiatives and performance-led activities and initiatives. Granted, we're in a more disaggregated market than a direct-to-consumer business like a Verizon or a Delta or an AT&T, but we do have an upper and lower funnel, but we treat it in a way that it's about the brand holistically. And how that shows up in the boardroom is, if you saw our monthly performance review, we, Timothy and I and our CEO, we share a boss, as you imagine, and we talk about volume, we talk about market share, we talk about penetration, we talk about brand equity, and we talk about all of those things all the time. And some are short term, and some are purely fiscal, if you will, and some are equity based. But we're trying to run the business and the portfolio in a balanced way. Equity might not pay the bills next week, but it will help us pay the bills next year.
For longer term.
And over the longer term. So it's about having both. The upper and lower funnel performance as brand or vice versa. The good news with us, Fergus, is we can actually bring you for a free beer. And that's something we should discuss for hours, which we can do. That's a philosophical conversation. But for us, we see it holistically, that everything you do aggregates to brand. And that's how we try to treat it.
So Timothy, when you came to Heineken, was this language of brand natural for you? Were you hired because you have that view of brand as well as your other skills? You know what I mean? Was it something that was culturally new to the language of finance for you?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely something where Johnny and his team have really brought me into this broader way of thinking, and where I think the U.S. has also been a fit for me in terms of career and career opportunities, coming from, like I said before, the 6 years in Africa, which had really different market dynamics. So coming over to the U.S., which is also in our industry, the largest profit pool in the world and the most competitive, definitely brought a new set of eyes in these this way of looking at how brand and to create the necessary pull to make sure that the consumers in the end will buy you and want to be associated with your brand.
So I know that every listener here is going to be wondering, Johnny, what did you do to convert Tim or to encourage Tim along that journey?
Yeah, I brought him to the upfront. Is a very practical example, Fergus, which, as all marketeers know but will never admit, is quite some good fun. I think we've tried to think about things in a joined up way. So let's take a concrete example. How can you have a pricing conversation internally in terms of brand strategy and pricing, which is theoretically an entirely financial and fiscal conversation, without understanding if you have the equity to command those price increases? And so that's an example of how we join things up, because in a one-dimensional conversation, you look at your cost base, you look at the market, and you say, you know, what should we do? And in a multidimensional conversation, you say, what can we do and what's going to work and what's not? And you understand across the total brand strategy, whether it's distribution, what markets you focus on, your positioning in the market, your investments, you understand those things more holistically. So I think the unlock for us was to try and transition the substantial investment we make and to accept that it is Timothy's role to deeply understand, like, what are we doing with that budget? Because he's the CFO, and that's not a weird question. He's not interfering. He's not poking around. He's not undermining us. He's the CFO, and he deserves to understand it. And we have a responsibility to make sure he understands what we're doing as the custodian of our financial performance. At the same time, you want to make sure he understands why we're trying to do the things we're trying to do. And it might not be everyone's experience, but ours, maybe it's because of where we started in a company that believes in the discipline. There's a dividend for bringing him in. And every CMO will recognize the chapters in their career where your number one priority was to keep the CFO out. And I just don't buy into that concept, because if something goes wrong, if you need help, when things aren't working, who's the first person you go talk to? The CFO. So you better have a relationship with him or her, because there will be moments when only the CFO can help you. So yes, it's a philosophical start point. It's not entirely altruistic. But I think the thing we've debunked is it's not Timothy's money, Timothy's budget or my money. It's the money and the investment. And together we try to work out what to do with it. Doesn't mean we agree on everything, but it means we take the time to understand where we're coming from. And maybe that's been the unlock, but mostly taking him to the upfront.
We have also a common set of KPIs and incentives that we're all trying to chase. And in those incentives that we have, or the KPIs we're trying to say, in the end, it's business performance. And business performance is not just short term or only long term. And that's why I think where we need to meet together in terms of delivering on our promises. And it can be, and it's a combination of top line and bottom line. So there is definitely a joint interest there.
And that's a key point, because an awful lot of folks would say that if your KPIs are aligned, generally at least the major one is sales, the major KPI, that then if the goal is to get that higher, sometimes people do things that aren't best for the long term in order to get those short term numbers up. There has to be a temptation to allow that to happen, Tim. Do you have to defend against that, or is it a situation where sometimes you have to do that because the business requires it and sometimes you don't?
Yeah, I think that especially looking back at the last couple of years with a lot of disruptions, we saw the supply chain disruptions worldwide, they have hit us as well. We've seen a lot of, I think our inventory had a lot of problems getting here. What do you need to do to still deliver on certain metrics? And that's where Johnny said it, you know, you bring the issue back to the table. And as a management team, you're looking at the company performance with the budget, and you're trying to marry both of them, but also not shooting you too much in the foot for the coming years and doing irrational or making irrational decisions that will hurt you too much on the long term.
There's no doubt, Fergus, that we, like every particularly CPG organization, feel short-term pressure. I mean, as a beer brand and a beer portfolio, you have to win things like 4th of July or Memorial Day or Labor Day. And those are legitimate short-term commercial pressures. There's also a third leg to this stool, which is our chief sales officer, who's integrated in all of these conversations as well. And we try to find the right balance to, you know, like all businesses, balance commercial performance for the short term versus doing the right thing in the long term for the brands. And so there are Thursdays when there are difficult conversations about what to do, but they take place in the context of where are we headed. We've got a very clear ambition. We've got a very clear set of values as an organization, both here in the US and internationally. And we have a few North Stars. But it's what's enjoyable to work in an organization that has these beliefs is the gentleman to my right is as likely to ask a question about brand equity as I am. If we are doing things that, you know, feel overly aggressive or whatever that might be. So those conversations come from all corners of the boardroom table and are worked through. But yeah, we, of course, have pressure, short-term pressure and long-term pressure to build a business, but build it right.
So, Tim, can you describe how you see your role at the company, not just your role in the marketing group, but how would you describe your role overall? What is it your job to do?
Ooh. I would love to see my role being a strategic partner in the end to the CEO of the company here, helping to ensure that part I would say financial discipline and financial performance, but also broader in terms of helping the strategic thinking overall and helping in the end business performance. And it could be in all the different metrics, whether you go from people discussions towards allocation discussion between, could be sales, could be marketing initiatives. But that's where I would see my role. And maybe lastly, on top of that, partly guardian of the assets and the reputation in a certain sense.
And the same question to you, Johnny, what's your role?
I mean, fundamentally, the role is to build brand power and build the most iconic portfolio of beer brands in the world, which sounds very lofty, and it's very hard. It's not an easy task. But I think the crucial distinction is to do it in the right way, to do it and build a portfolio of brands that endure for the long term and that because there are hacks, as you know, Fergus, to deliver short-term equity bumps. But building equity for the long term is your ultimate safeguard for the long-term viability of the organization. So for me, it's building a magnetic portfolio, improving brand power in order to deliver disproportionately positive commercial performance and to unlock margin. We're not trying to do marketing for the sake of the marketing. We're trying to do world-class marketing to unlock long-term growth and ultimately profitability for our shareholders, our partners, our customers, but do it in a way that gives consumers joy. And if you can balance that, it's pretty cool. And so, but it's a difficult thing to do. We're trying to do it right. I guess that's really the message there.
Yeah, and you heard Johnny speak a couple of times about balance, and I think that's a word that comes back a lot also in the way we're trying to do things, and it's not just about indeed short term hacks or little spikes in performance. In the end, it's a balanced performance, but also over the long time and doing things right, and also growing our sustainability and responsibility metrics. So it's. I think there are many, many aspects in what we call balanced, and where we're trying to, we're trying to ace on all of them, which is definitely not always easy.
And I guess we don't always get it right.
No.
I mean, that's the other thing. It all sounds wonderful theoretically, but there's tons of stuff we don't agree on, or tons of stuff we do agree on, and then we go and execute, and it's not perfect. But we try to make sure those are learning opportunities, and we talk about them and learn and do it better the next time.
So, Johnny, what is, and I'll come to Tim also with the same question. What is the thing, one or two things that you've learned from Tim that have made you a better partner to Tim? And that'll be the same question for Tim, but from what he's learned from you.
Yeah, I think for me, I have an acute understanding of the stakeholders that a CFO has to manage. Maybe as a CMO, we sometimes struggle a bit with victim culture, or we feel, you know, finance are, you know, because we can do a lot of podcasts, Fergal, and interviews where people ask you about, quote unquote, the difficult CFO, who's actually your business partner. And I think what Timothy has helped me with is to understand what it is he's trying to do. So I understand where the questions are coming from. I understand why he's asking the things he's asking for. I accept why they're legitimate, as opposed to, you know, feeling defensive about those things. And so he's helped me to understand the kind of stakeholder landscape, and the kinds of conversations that he's having with his stakeholder group. You know, and that they seem obvious, but it's important to look at things like productivity, like margin, you know, how we innovate, why we're innovating in areas, why we overinvest in some things or disproportionately invest in others. And so learning about the conversations he's having across the wider finance community has been extremely helpful. But also just understanding that his role, knowing that he sees his role as being here to help me and the commercial teams unlock market performance. That is a big step change, because then you head towards partnership rather than, you know, an adversarial relationship, which again, almost all CFOs and CMOs have experienced.
How about for you, Tim?
Oh. Well, the part I will resonate the whole part on we have different stakeholders, we have sometimes different views on how things work, or but I would say we touched upon this a bit earlier in the discussion, understanding how fundamentally the whole media landscape works in the US, what the drivers are around brand power, how we're testing new either product launches or commercials, the whole science behind it, our commercial effectiveness and modeling. I think Johnny has been a great partner to speed up my whole knowledge in that area. And then beside that, I would say as a person, Johnny is a very energetic, creative and resourceful person who's also a great person to come to if you have any questions on how to bring a message or how to energize a group of people, because he has a superpower of being able to rephrase something in a very compelling way where you leave even energized, even when you have to go and do a shitty thing as a budget cut or something else. And then in the end, the continuous going back towards it's the company, it's our money, and we're all here for the same goal is something that Johnny does, I think, very well. And in the end, being a great team player and partner around the boardroom.
We're going to have a quiet. They're going to suspect that there's something weird going on. I'll give you an insight. The first thing because I often feel as well in marketing, we're very quick to assume that everyone should understand us. And we're supposed to be master communicators. So isn't it, as a CMO, if you're not able to communicate with your CFO, isn't that something that the CMO should look at? You know, is it really his job to understand our discipline, or is it ours to help him understand? But I'll go to a practical example, which might help some of your listeners. The day Timothy arrived, I burst into his office and handed him The Case for Creativity by James Herman, which effectively tries over 30 years to decode why better creative is good for business. And I said, you like numbers, right? And there are some numbers in this book, so have a read over the weekend. And, you know, it wasn't about Timothy accepting the tenet of the case for creativity, the book. It was about me demonstrating, look, I understand you're going to need some ammo here, some understanding, and I'm here to help you wrap your head around what we're doing. But this stuff works. And so, you know, I think it is incumbent on the CMO to help the CFO understand. Programmatic is complex. First party data is complex. The upfront, I mean, we joke about the upfront, but the upfront only happens in the US. And so if you've got an international CFO and CMO like Timothy and I didn't understand it when I got here either. So you shouldn't, as a CMO, assume that they have to invest in understanding your stuff, because the very basis of marketing is us telling our stories to other people. Why would that be any different in the boardroom? And it's not about manipulating your CFO, but it's important to educate them and help them understand, like, what are you doing, you know, with Netflix? What are you doing with Paramount? What are you doing with the New York Times? What are we doing with the Trade Desk? These are good conversations to have. And so, yeah, keeping the door open probably is the underlying thing, but trying to help him understand what it is and moving it from this amorphous blob of investment and money. Mm-hmm. Because if the CFO feels this is just a bucket of cash, then it feels like a cost. And my number one objective is to make sure Timothy never sees it as a cost, but sees it as an investment.
Why did you think he needed to read James Herman's book?
Well, because I think creativity maybe is the least understood sub-discipline within marketing. Perhaps, perhaps salience is understood or spontaneous awareness is understood, but really trying to unlock why world-class creativity drives disproportionate business impact is fascinating. It's also it's a very interesting topic, as opposed to arriving on day one with your market mix model, because you want to have a broader conversation. So I thought that was a good place to start.
And everybody's trying to hit this creative thing or come out after your or in your different stints with the perfect creative commercial or plan or whatever moves the needle. But it's everybody's chasing this. It's like, for every successful startup, there's hundreds that fail. And I think believing in it and knowing what it can do, and I think it's important to understand. And John, and for the CFO listeners there, if you have a finance town hall inviting marketeers or even salespeople, makes things more fun, because in the end, it is about these inspirational stories. It is about believing in what we're doing, our long-term investments that also help in the end, you know, your employee engagement and the belief and the help the attrition rates as well in your company.
We'll be right back. This series is brought to you by Analytic Partners, a global leader in measurement and optimization. Since 2000, Analytic Partners has been helping companies evolve beyond marketing mix modeling and multi-touch attribution to commercial analytics. This privacy-safe solution is trusted by CMOs and CFOs to provide actionable insights from enterprise data, not just marketing data. Learn more about evolving your measurement to commercial analytics by visiting analyticpartners.com/onstrategy. That's analyticpartners.com/onstrategy. Now back to the show. So, Johnny, in the past, when you've had, when you've worked with other CFOs, and maybe they had a different reaction than Tim has had about creativity and marketing, what would you do? What did you learn you had to do when you were faced with resistance?
Yeah, and I've worked in direct response. Like, I worked in telco, for example, where you're getting, we always talk about signals, right? You're getting immediate real-time signals back from your activity and what you're deploying. I think the key thing is to continue to explain and advocate for the role of brand as a disproportionate unlocker of growth on the top line. That only marketing through innovation, through world-class creativity, through magnetic activities for consumers, can deliver disproportionate value creation.
And is that when you say deliver growth on the top line, are you talking about in terms of being able to charge a premium, or are you talking about longer term growth? How do you think about it? When does brand and when should brand deliver?
I mean, pretty much all the time. And it's not only about premium pricing. Your brand can also help deliver in commoditized industries disproportionately in terms of market share.
Yeah.
Your brand can act as a badge for safety or recognition. That's an instantaneous shortcut for consumers. Tide, Geico, Heineken, Ferrari, they might have different philosophical start points, from salience to, an awareness-based model through to a much more magnetic, meaningfulness model. But brands, by definition, are shortcuts for people in order to get them to do things. And when you don't have the philosophical buy-in, you have to default to the language of the CFO. And so I'm very fortunate right now we get to talk about investments, money, budgets, equity, brand power in a very balanced way. But if necessary as a CMO, when you have maybe someone who doesn't believe, you've got to get the conversation onto terms that they understand, which is revenue, margin accretion, growth, market share, profitability, and in order to defend the role of the discipline. And again, that's a part of the job. You can't be resentful, and you cannot walk around businesses your entire career saying, why don't they understand us? It's our job to help the CFO understand why this adds disproportionate value. And different CFOs, like consumers, have different needs.
Mm-hmm.
And as a marketeer, isn't your job to identify needs and solve them? So good CMOs find a way to move the conversation and deliver it in a way that works for that CFO and that corporate culture. And I've worked at Diageo, I've worked at Telefonica, I've worked at Heineken, a very interesting, diverse range of organizations with very different philosophical views of the world. But marketing's about adjusting your message for impact. And that's, I think, our job, Fergus, not the CFO's job.
So, Tim, if you were the CMO, how would you pitch or defend a marketing investment?
I'm really looking forward to this. Taking notes, Fergus, on this one.
I don't know how to read this question either. How I should enhance what I sometimes would like to see more of. Like I said, I think the energy and the belief, I think, are for me the first thing. You know, if you would come in, if a CMO would come in and already hesitant, I don't know if this is really going to work, but let's try and let's put X million on the table for this. But I'm really not sure. You know, as a CFO, I think your spire senses would start coiling up.
Even he doesn't believe it.
No, he doesn't. I think that the first part, I think, is the energy, the conviction part. But the great part, I think, how you can hook on a CFO is adding different metrics of success in there. And we use a commercial effectiveness model. We can understand what ROIs are driving, what ROIs are linked to certain initiatives, and how allocation models can further optimize, in the end, top line, mostly top line or bottom line delivery of financial results, which is in the end key on in terms of the whatever fiscal year or period you're tracking. But I think that's where a CFO will definitely get hooked into.
When you look at those metrics, how do you know that you can believe those metrics? And I'm not talking about the ones that Johnny presents you with, but the CFO role in general, I've got to assume you need a pretty, as much as you can, an ironclad case, or at least a case that's believable to you. How do you judge data and its believability when it's projecting ahead rather than behind?
We have a marketing mix model in place delivered by a third party supplier. And I think that brings a lot of internal belief or judgment of the table, you know, and which is driven by a large model of multiple organizations all all looking at the same set of data and correlation between certain certain patterns.
You've got to have a benchmark set of data that everybody agrees upon is going to be the data.
Yes, yes, because it takes. Hey, Johnny believes this. I believe that off the table, and I believe, and that is this difficult part of being a CMO is that everybody has an opinion on how to do certain brand campaigns. Everybody has a different feeling on when they watch something, and in the end, it's bringing back. I think today's technology has the ability to bring large sets of data back in a consumable way. And in the end, we say, okay, we invest in a certain model. We believe in what the outcome is. And that takes a lot of the, I think, the subjective or whatever Johnny or I believe off the table. And it's also data driven and data led.
And I think first we lean into a lot of third party is ultimately empirical evidence. So whether that's Kantar, analytics partners, whatever your mixed model partner is, if you can transition the data from my data or his data to the data based on industry benchmarks, whether they be global methodologies for us, because we track our brand equity in the same way in 170 countries, we can verifiably see that X or Y is happening, as opposed to I think something, or I like something, or I believe something. So you certainly need some enthusiasm at the start and some belief. Or if you are fortunate enough to have the right relationship as a CMO, there are moments when you're not sure and you can say it if you're in the right environment, which is, we think this will happen. We're not 100% sure, but we're going to try it. And you need to obviously articulate why you think something will work. We try to move the conversation to analytically based empirical data to say what is actually happening. And those metrics are not uniquely financial. So we do ROI analysis, post-campaign analysis, but we also talk about things like spontaneous awareness, which is empirical data as well. It's not collected by my team. It's collected in the market by Nielsen or Kantar, or take your provider. So we try to have visibility on multi-source independent data that gives us, you know, directional or direct, because we can look at things like sales and market share, of course, that we have in our own data sets. We try to look at internal, external, empirical data to say what worked and what didn't. Mm-hmm. However, there's always the tension of attribution. Is can you and can any brand or any CMO universally say that the correlation between activity X and outcome Y is 100%. That's very rare when you're not in a direct response business. But we try to at least elevate those conversations.
So Tim, when you look out at the marketing agencies that you guys work with, and there may be some you've worked with in the past, what do you wish agencies understand more about your role? And the reason I bring this up is because sometimes I think agencies and people like myself, when I was coming up in my career, the CFO was like, I thought was like a villain. He was not my friend. I would avoid him in the hallway, not literally, but figuratively, because I thought that all he wanted to do or she wanted to do was save money, which was which just seemed to be foreign to me because I wanted to have more invested, not less spent.
No, yeah, I think there you touched the key point. I'm not here just to go after savings or cost cutting. That's, I think in the end, and I think most CFO would agree with me, is that we get the highest energy of increased business performance. And doing that without top line growth is, in the end, a short term. Is only a short-term play, and being able to continue to grow and invest behind whatever works, and it's not always the marketing things. It could also be some sales initiatives that work very well. But in the end, enhancing business performance and going after that, that is in the end what is key. And I am here to pick up the phone if a bill is not paid, but that's not the only thing. I think we we as CFOs could benefit by talking much more to also all these agencies, and the agencies could benefit by inviting us more often to understand what is on offer, what are the new trends, why we should invest ahead of the curve in certain in whatever it is, initiatives, toolings, new platforms, in the end to drive the business performance that we're all chasing.
Fergus, I'm struck by something just listening to Timothy, and you are operating in the agency landscape and in the wider community, but I'm sure over the last 2 years you've had 100 conversations around how the agency model is challenged, profitability is difficult, consolidation, sustainability of the industry model and the agency models, etc. And most of those conversations end with a conversation around viability, profitability, margin, sustainability. And those conversations are happening with CMOs. But aren't many of those conversations the language of the CFO?
Right.
I think that Timothy's dealing day to day more with how it must be to run Dentsu or Publicis or insert your agency. He probably understands the mechanics of running a business like that better than I do as a CMO, but those conversations around the viability of our industry are happening amongst the participants in the industry. And it might be very interesting for agency leads to also share the business that they're trying to run with our CFO so that you can have different conversations around fees and revenue and payment terms and God knows what else that typically the CMO doesn't always get involved in.
No.
So it's an interesting way in, but I think running an agency is super hard. Being a CMO is hard. Being a CFO is very hard. I wonder, do they have more in common, I guess, is my question, than we actually think?
I would like to think that also. Tim, go ahead.
And in the end, we're both trying to run a business and also probably a long-term partnership when things work, and understanding each other's difficulties and operating models is absolutely beneficial. So I like that addition very much, Johnny. And we hear it, but it's a different story when Johnny comes in and says, hey, this or that cost is just going up 15%, and that's the market industry, so my budget needs to go up with 15%. And what I'm also hearing is that we said this also from where we use our marketing mix modeling, the third party or the other party, and understanding what the challenges are in the different industries to also help procurement and our own buying departments to understand what the realities is that our partners are facing, and what the impact would be on our business.
One of the most interesting conversations we ever had was trying to explain to someone who's a CFO that because fewer people are watching TV, it's getting more expensive.
I know, yeah, that's a crazy one, isn't it?
I've had three or four goes.
The scarcity strategy, yeah.
But think about, I mean, it's quite a funny example, but actually think about the logic of that for someone who's wired like a CFO should be wired. And honestly, the first three times he's looking across the table, literally saying, but can you explain this again? So, you also have to take some of the stuff and smile.
So I wanted to touch on how the conversation starts in the entire budget planning cycle. So as an outsider, a naive outsider, admittedly, the way that, and I have my rebel Irish blood in me, of course, so the way I kind of think about it is that a CEO decides with his or her leadership team, but mostly coming from the CEO, of setting objectives for the year, which seem to us down in the agency world to be so bizarre, right? Maybe they're not necessarily realistic, but they're goals, et cetera. And then what we start to feel from the agency side is, how are we ever supposed to achieve this on this budget? So I'm curious, how does that whole process start? Does it start off with a set of objectives that are just handed to both of you? Or are you, which I kind of feel you are you deeply involved in setting those objectives? And so that budget and marketing budget isn't disconnected in some bizarre way from ever being able to achieve that goal.
Yeah, the latter. I think we're fortunate to work in an organization that, and it might be partially our structure where, you know, we still have family participation in the business. We're very built for the long term. We have a deep level of connection between what we're trying to do and how we go after doing it in terms of like the budgets and the investment to go after it. Look, no CSO or CMO will ever admit to having sufficient investment. We're taught that in first year in college. But it is, to your point, very important to connect the investment to the aspiration. And I certainly don't feel that we have that level of disconnect because the conversations happen simultaneously. So what you described is a very sequential process of here are the objectives. Here is the, let's say, commercial firepower. Dear agency colleagues, what are the activities? We compress that process and do it simultaneously using a methodology, which is we have the objectives. We then have and build our brand plans, which deliver specific quantitative jobs to be done. What is it that we're trying to achieve this year? And a how dimensionality to that with the investment connected. So I think we're fortunate that we have an environment that takes a longer term view of what success looks like, which is not to say we don't have short term pressures. But we compress the planning process to close the gaps between aspiration and reality, because as you alluded to in your question, sometimes those things are totally disconnected. I don't think in my time at Heineken I've ever started the race of a year and thought this is a suicide mission. It might be challenging and they might be ambitious, but you're always in with a shot, and that's important because it retains talent both internally and via our agency partners. We tend not to go after things that are deeply unrealistic. It's not to say we have everything we want and everything we need, and we don't have pressure.
No, we're absolutely part of the discussion, and then we understand the requests that are coming and handed down to us, what expectations are. But on the other side of the table, we have a team that also tries to really understand the local dynamics and the challenges. And as Johnny said, there are often a couple of metrics that are definitely a stretch, or we say, okay, we will need to have some trade-offs, and can we hit every ball out of the park and achieve everything? No, we're also living indeed in a constrained environment where resources are scarce on different fronts. But the dialogue and understanding and what we need to do, or corrective actions, or the longer term planning in the strategic plan sessions are key to rebalance the I think different views and what performance looks like in our industry.
Fergus, I can maybe give you a real example, because that sounds very theoretically, right? So your listeners might say, well, okay, what? Look at Heineken Zero. We have a market-leading position in non-alcoholic beer. It's a significant percentage of the mother brand, has been growing double digits for 5 years, all of which is capitalizing on a macro consumer trend around health, wellness, and moderation. But the organization took a decision in 2019 to invest $50 million a year behind the non-alcoholic launch, the launch of Heineken Zero in the non-alcoholic beer market. The non-alcoholic beer market in the US is significantly underdeveloped versus most advanced global beer markets. But we're betting on it because it's a mega trend, it's consumer-centric, and it's for the long term. And having taken that decision in 2019 and repeatedly investing in category development, destigmatizing the category, making moderation cool, we've unlocked a massive penetration, revenue, and volume driver for our business. Because we weren't doing non-alcoholic, entering non-alcoholic beer with Heineken Zero for the next 2 quarters. We're entering it for the next 20 years to have a sustainable business that's consumer-centric and profitable. So we invested ahead of the curve. So it goes to that like strategic intent and then matching your activities and closing the gap between intent, ambition, and what you actually do.
Is the starting point last year's budget? You know, I've had conversations with Mark Ritson on the show about how he feels budget is established. And I, as I think back of it, back on it, it was basically this idea that it's basically last year's budget and you've got to start from there. Is that the way you guys are? Or are you looking at tasks to be achieved and it's basically zero balance or zero based and you've got to build the case for what you need? Because sometimes you need more and you're not getting anywhere near enough.
Yeah, from my point of view, it's a mix of both. I think in certain aspects, and if you look at certain fixed cost buckets, we try really to build a zero-based budget approach where you say, okay, what do we need to do? What are, do we have some cost drivers? And you multiply and you rebuild it from zero. And I would say we know that we could further invest and that we have not hit our saturation levels, for example, in the commercial spend. I think the budget on that side starts more from a combination of a percentage of revenue that we want to at least hit and invest, because we've seen it disproportionately feedback into growth and what we're building off and what certain one-offs were to correct for the new launch or anything else. So I would say it's a combination for us.
Yeah, I don't think you can ever realistically, I mean, you want to suspend disbelief and start with pure ZBB. But there is always the context of prior year, you know, even just norms, your resources. I mean, let's say if you never look to last year, let's imagine your marketing budget tripled. You don't have the resources to deploy that accurately. So there's always an element of context and where you've been. At the same time, we try to build a plan bottom up in terms of, you know, what is it that we're trying to achieve and how are we best stacking the deck to make sure we deliver against those objectives. So I you know, ZBB is a crucial part of that because it's the suspension of disbelief and you build a plan bottom up. But I do think there's always a context, which is what have you done before? Not to say you copy paste, but just to understand what's what and what's a realistic ask as well. Mm-hmm. However, if you have a big intervention, like a significant launch or you know, a unique innovation in a given year, then you're having that conversation separately as a sort of strategic pillar. So I think you've got to be cognizant of where you're going, but also accept that where you were is always going to have some bearing on the conversation.
Exactly. And we use it heavily in reallocation of budgets. If Johnny and the team, we found during things that work particularly well, it's okay, how do we reinvest more from that? Where do we take it from and how do you deploy it? Because in the end, can you do it? And can the partners do it? Can you buy an asset? Can you go after a sponsorship? It all needs to fit into a form of reality.
So Tim, does brand equity live on your balance sheet as an asset? Is it a line item or is it just something you guys are conscious of as being playing a critical role in marketing and reputation? But is that assigned?
No, I would say it doesn't live on the balance sheet unless you purchased anything and it lives in a bit more under the line item of goodwill. But it doesn't live and it doesn't get restated or reevaluated in our balance sheet.
An awful lot of conversation is happening, and I'm a huge advocate for it, about marketing effectiveness, creative effectiveness, and you guys are big advocates of that too. When I look at Ehrenberg Bass, I look at Les Bennett, I look at Analytic Partners, their ROI genome. There's a lot of data. There's a lot of marketing science content out there. Are there some of the sort of the principles of marketing effectiveness that you guys are skeptical of? Are you fully bought in, or are there aspects of it that you're like not sure is you know playing out so well in the US market?
Yeah, I think everyone's searching for a dogmatic, definitive view of the world, and haven't we always started with the idea that it's a social science? There's art and science in the discipline. I mean, philosophically, as a company, we believe in broad reach. But we also believe in doing amazing things that are truly magnetic to consumers. So I think for us, it's not what's right, what's wrong, what's the doctrine that we believe in. We believe in brand. We believe that brand disproportionately unlocks top line performance and ultimately performance that flows through to the bottom line, because in most cases, in most of our markets around the world, it allows us to behave as a premium portfolio of brands, particularly with the world's most iconic beer brand in Heineken at the top of the tree. So I think what I'm skeptical of isn't so much the model, whether it's Byron Sharp or Binet and Field or whoever. It's our belief is that performance and brand all touch consumers who are called people who form opinions about your brand holistically. And for us as a marketing function in a premium portfolio, in a pull market that can be at times commoditized, we focus a lot on the lowest common denominator, our brand. What's the least exciting thing you've done? What's the least fabulous thing you've done? What's the most commoditized you've done? And to stop doing those. And because magnetism is critical. We know when people see our brands, if I take the Heineken brand for experience from direct experience and everyone we talk to, when they see that brand, they know that whatever is happening there is better. And if that is at the US Open or at Coachella or at the Oscars or wherever, whatever we're doing is elevated. We elevate social situations. We elevate socializing. We bring people together. Consumers don't necessarily play those things back, but they feel them and they know them in their core. And so our focus is on making the brand worth it.
Do you look at some of the performance of channels and think, okay, well, this is not working the way it used to? Some circles would say the world is falling apart for paid media. What say you?
No, I think it's about, look, do I believe all our signals are completely perfect? No, the 5 years ago, every conversation like this was like, well, how much are you spending on digital? As if this, you know, as if I was going to change the world. We're just adapting all the time, and our media mix has changed fundamentally. But at the same time, so we're not in a direct response business. So one of our challenges, which is very difficult, especially in the relationship between a CMO and a CFO in a disaggregated business, is that we sell to a distributor who sells to a customer who sells to a consumer. So there's lag, as opposed to those very firm, direct signals you get if you're sitting at Verizon or AT&T. And the folks at AT&T and Verizon would say, look at you. And I'm envious of how quick their response metrics work, and vice versa. They're probably envious of how much time I get to see do things work. We have for sure have weak spots. We for sure are focusing on things like attribution, you know, like the efficacy of our spend, but also the continued role of, let's call it, you know, TV and broadcast for building awareness quickly. Again, for us, it's not one thing. One thing is uniquely true and everything else is wrong. We, like all marketeers, I think the role has always been to find the right mix. That hasn't changed. What that mix is changing. Oh my, I mean, you know better than I, by the week. And the conversations I'm having today about first party data, about programmatic, about all of those things are different to the conversations I was having 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But it's about what is the right mix to unlock the growth. That is a fundamental.
That does seem to be the key to all of this, is having agreed upon metrics that you all feel that all of your activities you feel are reflected in, Johnny. There's this sense that you've got that established benchmark for everything. And it also makes sense why you then would be sort of handing Tim this book on the case of creativity, because most of the other metrics will support the spend. It's the creative idea that you've got to get buy-in and understanding at the C-suite level for. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does, because everyone can buy salience. and it's a purchase, and you can buy enough airtime and geo keys and invest enough programmatically to have salience. But we need to layer on differentiation and meaningfulness, and that comes from creativity. And so you certainly need that buy-in. So yeah, that chimes for me. It's about making sure that we're not just transacting either internally, or that we as a marketing function are transacting outside, but that we're actually doing things that are impressive, iconic, make sense to people. And if you wanted to work for the couple of hundred million people outside your walls, it wouldn't be a bad start to make sure it works for the six or seven people who sit around the table with you day to day running the business. And yeah, we don't do that because we want to manipulate the boardroom. We do it because they're also people with views, and they're smart, and they've seen stuff, and they can give you tips. But the reason we invest in the relationship is, you know, we're making decisions. We have a bunch of employees and distributors and partners who are, you know, enjoying our products, but they're also paying their bills and sending kids to college with the salaries they get here. And they're building businesses in distribution centers around the country. We're very conscious of the responsibility you have. When you work on a brand that's 150 years old, you get your hands on it for a millisecond in the big picture. And your job is really simple. It's to leave it better than when you got it. And I think we have that philosophy at the boardroom. And it's not about running marketing or running finance. It's about leaving it better than how we got it. I think that's what we're aiming for.
It is Johnny Cahill, Chief Marketing Officer, Heineken USA out of New York, and Tim Bodart, Chief Financial Officer at Heineken USA. Thank you both so much for your time. It's been a real riveting conversation, and I know it's going to stir a lot of others as people begin to hear this episode. Thanks for your time, guys.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Nice talking to you.
And we will see everyone on the next episode.